This is the podcast version of the YouTube series From Here to the Stars, which is created by the Interstellar Research Group. Our guest today is Dr. Cameron M. Smith. Dr. Smith is a prehistorian at Portland State University's Department of Anthropology, focusing on human evolution, past, present, and future. Our guest today is Dr. Cameron M. Smith. Dr. Smith is a prehistorian at Portland State University's Department of Anthropology. His research interests include evolutionary adaptation, evolution of hominin cognition, space settlement, space exploration paradigms, and technologies. He has written almost a dozen books, has been widely published in peer-reviewed technical journals, and has written for the general public in many magazines, including Scientific American, Archaeology, and Spaceflight. He has been featured on many television programs, such as the History Channel, Discovery Channel, and the National Geographic Channel. Thank you for taking the time for this interview, Doctor.
Oh, well, thank you for entertaining this new, well, it's an old idea, but this idea of a human future beyond Earth.
Okay. Doctor, your latest book is entitled Principles of Space Anthropology, Establishing a Science of Space Settlement. I have many questions about it, but first, I want to ask about your efforts in building cheaper, simpler spacesuits. It has been featured in Wired, Rolling Stone, Popular Science, and many other magazines. It has also resulted in your being invited to present your ideas to a number of space research organizations worldwide. If you would, tell us about your ideas for spacesuits and perhaps about the progress being made in promoting your ideas.
You bet. The spacesuit is the first layer of material human adaptation beyond Earth. It is analogous to the parka worn by an Arctic native person in the high Arctic. You don't survive without that object in the Arctic or in space. And the spacesuit is something that I could work on in a material sense with regard to the distant human future beyond Earth. It was something that I could work on physically rather than being entirely involved intellectually, just thinking about it, making PowerPoints and diagrams. This is something that I could physically work on. When I looked into the history of spacesuits or pressure garments, whatever we want to call them, I saw that in the 1930s, they were able to build these that took them to 50 and 60,000 feet in balloons. And I thought, surely, if they could build those in the 1930s and make them function, with no expertise, there was no Department of Space Sciences or something like this. They were people sitting around thinking about how do I inflate a suit, inflate a garment that provides oxygen, disposes of CO2, provides thermal protection and so on. And they simply were cutting material and gluing it together and making that function. And I thought if they could do that in the 1930s with their materials, surely I could do that here on my dining room table, 100 years later. And here we are, and it's working.
Have you run any trials of these suits?
A great many. We've been in altitude chambers. We've been to 25,000 feet in various aircraft several times. Mm-hmm. And this has proved out the basic design. But vacuum chambers, actual 100% vacuum chambers, are hard to access. NASA Houston is $10,000 per hour in a vacuum chamber. The FAA in Oklahoma will only take you to 25,000 feet. Well, I can get there in a balloon or in an airplane, so that doesn't help. And so the natural world is going to be our test bed. We're going to take our balloon to about 63,000 feet. That's the what's called the Armstrong limit, where if a pressure suit isn't functioning, you're not going to survive. And that's a long-term project. We've been working on that for about 10 years now. And we have our balloons and we have our whole system working. We even have clearance from the FAA to fly to any altitude in the northern Nevada area. So we're working towards that. And we'll demonstrate that the suit actually functions. But it's a long project.
Mm-hmm. I've been following the space program probably since, at least Apollo, maybe a little bit of Gemini. But at any rate, I've always heard the main complaint of the astronauts about their suit is
the air pressure causes it to be real work to get the arms to bend, the legs to bend. The flexibility of the suit is restrictive. Yes. Yes. Have you approached that that aspect?
Well, when I hear the conspiracy theorists who say that Apollo, was staged, I think they're going after the wrong thing. If they want to say it was staged, they should tackle how difficult it is to make the spacesuit work, never mind the rocket. Because, because yes, at high pressure, 3.5 PSI, a bike tire is 80 PSI, a car tire is something like 30 PSI. Only 3.5 PSI are needed inside a pressure suit. But even at that pressure, the suit becomes hard. It is like wood when you pound on it. You will have a pressurized person and you can hit them with the fist on the chest of the suit and they don't even feel it. It is really extraordinary. So the holy grail of all spacesuits is not holding pressure. We've learned how to do that. It's not how to deliver O2 and dump O2. It's not thermal regulation. The holy grail of spacesuits is mobility at operational pressure. And we're working on ways using a folding technique of material, for example, origami folding techniques that give you an ability to move or to rotate and things like that while the suit is pressurized. So we're slowly coming along with that. Right now we have an acceptable range of pressure, but we're definitely trying to improve that and get beyond the Apollo range.
Would you like to contribute to the goal of achieving interstellar travel? Then join the IRG at the First European Interstellar Symposium, December 2nd through 5th, 2024, in Luxembourg. Go to irg.space for more information.
Before I get into the details of your book, I'd like to read a summary from Amazon. As much as Dr. Smith is interested in the human past, he is equally fascinated by the human future. To this end, he has in recent years been steadily building and publicizing an anthropological approach to the issues of human biological and cultural evolution beyond the boundaries of Earth. This book shows how anthropology can provide an innovative perspective on the human movement into space. It examines adaptation to space on timescales of generations rather than merely months or years, and uses evolutionary adaptation as a guiding theme. Employing the lessons of evolutionary adaptation, the book recommends evolutionarily sound strategies of space settlement, covering genetics at the organismal and population levels. The author organizes the concept of cultural adaptation to environments beyond Earth according to observed patterns in human adaptation on Earth. And I want to jump to chapter 3 of your book, talking mostly about lower limits of population, both in colonies and in world ships, which for anyone unfamiliar, a world ship is a large craft, sort of like a small city generally, which carries perhaps hundreds of people on a slow journey to another star system, which could take generations. So lower level of population. I want you to describe, if you would, for the listeners, the founder effect, the problems of interbreeding, and the extinction vortex, which is a phrase I'm not familiar with myself.
Sure. Well, yes, you put it well. A city type population on the way to a distant star generations away. This is such a mind-boggling concept. But the engineers have said that, yes, it can be done essentially. I work with Andreas Hein, for example, at the Icarus Interstellar and the Hyperion project. And generally speaking, the engineering says that, yes, a craft like this could be built. It's expensive and difficult, but generally speaking, it's not beyond physics. Okay. What about the populations? What about the populations aboard this vehicle? Going for multiple generations, how long can small populations survive? And you get immediately into the world of population genetics, which has to do with population genetic health, has to do with diversity of the population. And you have to ensure that there is a diversity at the beginning such that a closed population like this, that has no new people coming in and no people going out, really, a closed population has to have a genetic diversity such that there aren't the problems of small population inbreeding. We can see, for example, if you have close marriage inbreeding in modern human cultures, for example, Amish or other small populations that tend to breed among themselves, they have genetic disorders over some generations. So you need to avoid that. But another reason to maintain genetic diversity or begin a founder effect, begin with a genetically diverse population, is that you'd have no idea what new environments or what new selective agents are going to impinge really upon that population in the future. And genetic uniformity, there was that great film Gattaca, which I really love, but it has a bit of a wrong message. Mm-hmm. In Gattaca, the concept was that they were breeding a breed of superhumans, right, to go to space, only if you met all these criteria. Well, that's actually sort of the opposite of what you want. You want a wide variety of people because you don't know what the environmental selective pressures are going to be that you're going to encounter, and somebody has to survive. If everybody is uniform, then when you encounter some terrible catastrophe, a genetic catastrophe, then everybody is the same and they all die for the same reason, right? Mm. So what you want is genetic diversity rather than uniformity. So I go into ways that you would, that people would ensure that there's a genetically diverse population at the beginning by genetic screening, looking at the genetic constitution of people, and just ensuring that the population at the start, the founding population, is diverse rather than uniform.
Okay. And if you would explain the founder's effect and extinction vortex.
Oh, yes. So the founder effect is simply the term we use to describe the fact that the future genetic diversity of a population is in a way set by the originating population. So the population departing Earth, that will have no new population coming in and no population going out. They're a closed unit. That's that population that I was just describing that needs a diversity at the beginning. Hmm. Now, so founder effect has to do with the genetic future of a population being set by who goes in the who is it at the beginning, who establishes that population. An extinction vortex is a population phenomenon by which some catastrophe comes along and eliminates the breeding viable population of a population. So let's say that a disease sweeps through the colony ship, the world ship, whatever we want to call it. A disease sweeps through and doesn't affect the children, but it does affect people of viable reproductive age from the early teens into the late 40s, something like that. Mm-hmm. That's an extinction vortex. You can't get out of that. Now there are not enough people of sexually viable or reproductively viable age to continue the population. And it's a downward spiral from there.
Okay, hence the vortex, I see.
Yeah, you can't get out of it.
Estimating and modeling a viable population, what do we have as far as an understanding of the numbers of human beings that we would need in order to have a viable population?
An astronomer at Strasbourg University in France has actually come up with much better algorithms and a program to simulate population genetics than I ever did. And he's pretty much taken that field, which I'm happy to have him do that. I sort of reintroduced the problem and he said, oh, this is fascinating. Let me see what I can do with it. And he's light years ahead of me on that. So what I proposed or what I was describing really was that if we're going to send people into multi-generational voyages to different stars, then we have to maintain the genetic health of the population. Mm-hmm. And my main point, I suppose, was that we must get away from the concept of the minimum viable population, or MVP. You'll see it throughout the book. Mm-hmm. MVP, minimum viable population. That's the smallest number of people that genetically we can send who, interbreeding among themselves, are going to maintain their genetic health. Well, after thinking about it a bit, I suggested that we have to get away from that number, because you don't want to arrive after centuries at a destination exoplanet, let's say, with the minimum possible number of people who can make it work, because one catastrophe upsets that minimum population. And so I describe or introduce the concept, let's have a reserve or a larger than minimum population. Mm-hmm. My analogy is that when you get on an aircraft and you go to fly from Paris to New York, you don't want them to carry the minimum amount of fuel required to arrive in New York. You want to arrive with a reserve so that you can circle for a couple of hours in case there's a problem, and then you land. Mm-hmm. So with that research, I was tackling the minimum viable population, which you asked, you know, what is the number? And I can get to that in a second. But then mm-hmm. I realized, one thing I can contribute is, let's get away from that number, because the absolute minimum is a disaster waiting to happen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And do we have any idea of what the number might be?
Frédéric Marin, again, this astronomer at Strasbourg, we chat about it and we go back and forth. We don't know, because we've never really done this. The human population has never really done this. And even populations isolated on islands, that sort of thing, those are very rare. Human populations in anthropology, you find human populations always have trade and marriage contacts with other populations. Mm-hmm. There isn't really, except in the extreme case of castaways, there really isn't a study of a population that's, you know, entirely by itself. However, having said that, on the order of several hundreds to the low thousands appears to be genetically viable over multiple generations, let's say six 30-year generations, something like that. Mm-hmm. That seems to be viable. Mm-hmm. But I think I've persuaded Frederick that, you know, yes, you can publish a number of, you know, 450 people could be genetically viable for six centuries on the voyage to Alpha Centauri. However, it's a bad idea to arrive there with, you know, to just squeak in with the minimum. Let's design things such that you have a larger number.
When the mysterious black ships arrived, they devastated humanity's peaceful space settlements and obliterated their populations. Earth appears defenseless against the mysterious marauders. Two of humanity's finest starship captains must push themselves to the brink to save humanity from total annihilation by an enemy that will not identify itself or reveal its motives. Together, they will plumb the scientific wells of existence where the primordial knot of space-time may be unraveling. The Space-Time War by Les Johnson and BaneBooks.com.
Okay, yes. This is, of course, a recurring popular topic in science fiction novels and TV shows and movies.
Yeah.
Science fiction writers have, many of them, have included, say, frozen embryos, a frozen sperm or something, so that they can introduce more genetic variability. What would be, this may be out of left field and you're not ready to answer it, but what would be the minimum number of people that you could send that would use that method to increase their genetic diversity over time?
I think it could be in the high tens to the low hundreds. Mm-hmm. I think I've seen that sort of number with that technology. The reason that I avoided that technology, though, is that it is such a departure from what is normal to the human experience,
mm-hmm. Yeah,
which is parents having offspring and so on. Mm-hmm. One of the principles that I'm trying to promote in the anthropology of humans beyond Earth is that we should do things that are evolutionarily proven already and don't take big excursions from what evolution has already sculpted really well. Hmm. And so an excursion from that would be an experiment like taking embryos to increase our genetic diversity. Maybe that would work, but why not use a method that we already know works, a viable population, and just build the engineering to support that. One of the reasons that I'm focused on that is that when I speak with engineers about it, they have sometimes the concept of this as a mission rather than lifetimes of people playing out, having children, the children go to school, people get old and die. That's how it'll play out, is lifetimes of human beings, not people in uniforms packed into a sort of a submarine type thing. You can see on the space station, when people get up there, the moment they get up there, very quickly, they switch out of those jumpsuits wearing the flags and everything. They put on a t-shirt and a pair of, you know, sweatpants, basically.
Right, yeah.
And so very quickly, people want to have a normal life. They don't want to be on a mission for centuries. Mm-hmm. So for that and other reasons, I try to promote a conception of this where it is, you have to build a series of world ships or a set of these ships that fly in parallel or something like that, where people have normal lives and they're not a crew on a mission. They're people living out their lives. They just happen to be on the way to a distant star.
Yeah, if you're living on a world ship and you're not going to get off the world ship for the remainder of your life, and the next generation is also going to live on the world ship, it's going to have its own culture, its own environment. You want a real life. You want comfort. And
I think so. Think so. And it's a very, you know, I thought about how do you break up the experience of the people, or not break it up, but how do we conceptualize the experience of the people on board the voyage? And I thought about, well, in anthropology and archaeology, we always, well, in the Western tradition, we do things by threes, the Stone Age, the Bronze Age, the Iron Age, that sort of thing. So, okay, there are problems with that, but okay, let's throw that at this issue. And I thought about the Departure Age, the Interstellar Age, and the Arrival Age, maybe each of some centuries or some decades in duration. The people departing, we might start to think about, okay, they are making a departure from everything that humanity has ever done. And after, I thought about even some milestones. When is it that the last person who was born on Earth dies? When is it that the Earth is no longer physically visible or visible with telescopes or something like that? Right? These would be cultural landmarks or cultural timestamps in that experience. The strangest of all is the Interstellar Age, where there are people who have never experienced a planet and will never experience a planet. They're not going to arrive there. Their descendants will arrive there. And then there's the Arrival Age, where they've never experienced a planet, and yet now they're going to arrive at one or a solar system. And this will be new to their experience. It's sort of like a Renaissance experience. Where they discover, or they've known it theoretically, but certainly here it is, the moment of discovering it's not everything is about what's in their little world of this mechanical world, but there is a whole other possibilities. So if we start thinking about this in those sort of terms, you can start to think about what are the experiences, the cultural traditions and experiences of those people in these, you know, different phases of such a voyage.
Entering from Earth into a space ship like that would be meaning that you're giving up the open sky, you're giving up rain, you're giving up wind, all of these outdoor experiences that you've had, you know, at your fingertips all your life.
Yeah.
And suddenly now you're indoor all the time.
Yes.
Let me ask you about chapter 4, mechanisms and rates of culture change. You're a sociologist. It's your job. You study the mechanisms and rates of cultural change. So what would be, what are your thoughts on that as far as, and not just the world ship, but also the colonization phase, so to speak?
One of the main issues I tackled in the book was the question of how much are things going to change? Because when you start to chat with people about a voyage to a different star, very quickly, the engineering questions and so on, let's presume that those are solved, but those go away very quickly. And very quickly, you get into very heated debates oftentimes, because people want to describe what they think is the ideal society. And so I thought, all right, let's look at what does anthropology know, right? The scientific study of humanity, anthropology. What has humanity, what has anthropology found out about how cultures change or how they adapt and so on? And it turns out we have a very good body of knowledge in anthropology about cultures. We know about the rates of change, languages. It takes several centuries, typically several centuries from for a language offshoot to be completely unintelligible to its originators, let's say. So think of Old English in Shakespearean times. If you go to a Shakespearean play, you can kind of get the gist of it, but some of it's rather alien. That's about 5-6 centuries away, 500 years from before us, in older or middle sort of English. Okay, so we can say that, you know, that is a, you know, that's a ballpark figure for, okay, what are the rates of language change, let's say. Now, having said that, people can very quickly accelerate that if they want. For example, populations of settlers in new places oftentimes like to distinguish themselves from their prior generations by the invention of new languages, phrases, not entire languages, but phrases and vocabulary that describe their new conditions and intentionally set themselves off from where they started because for whatever reason, they want to be a new population. They want to be different from where they came from. And so we have some ballpark figures. And on the order of, let's say, 5-6 centuries to get to something like Alpha Centauri with reasonably imaginable technologies today, on the order of 5-6 centuries, if things change about like they have on Earth in recent centuries, you would have a population arriving that is physically slightly different from us, but noticeably, and culturally slightly different from us, but noticeably. Their language would probably be different, but not completely unintelligible. Genetically, they may or may not, I don't know if they would still be reproductively viable with human Earth populations, but I think that doesn't matter. They're light years away, so what's the point of saying, are they a different species or not? They're different. They're a variant of Homo sapiens from Earth. So they wouldn't, again, people ask about the scale of change. No, they shouldn't be, you know, just a ball of plasma. They're pretty much, you know, sentient plasma. No, they're probably going to be much like us in physical and cultural form, but somewhat transformed by their experiences.
That was Dr. Cameron M. Smith. This has been the podcast version of the YouTube series From Here to the Stars, which is created by the Interstellar Research Group. The IRG is a nonprofit organization dedicated to thoroughly exploring the science and engineering that can eventually open up the reality of interstellar travel. Find us online at irg.space. I have been your host, Stephen Ewan Cobb. If you enjoyed this video, please hit the like button, and you can subscribe to our channel for other such videos. On behalf of all of us here at the Interstellar Research Group, I thank you.